This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Maha Abdelmajid about her new book, Literary Optics, Staging the Collective in the Nahda, published by Syracuse University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Maha.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much, Maha. Maybe we can start with the first question that you tell us a bit about yourself, how you ended up where you are basically right now.
Okay, so this is a trickier question than it looks on the surface. So I enjoyed I enjoy that question. I think it's tricky to pinpoint the moment when I became interested in the study of literature, and I feel so much of what I'm doing with my life, or where I am, or where I live, is defined by the pursuit of the study of literature. And yet, I think I could have just as easily studied journalism or law or history or philosophy. These were and still are fields I'm interested in. But I think there are also just a series of coincidences and encounters with people that made literary studies important for me. But it became important precisely because it allowed me to think about questions and to think about the language with which I can think of those questions. So I am where I am because at some seemingly random moment, the exploration of questions of literary form and literary history became precisely the way in which I am able to ask questions about broader things, about how do we make sense of the world around us? Where does the history of that sense-making come from? Is it possible to change some of those dynamics? So I think this is kind of the broad way in which my interest in literature led me to where I am more generally everywhere in terms of just living in Beirut, or before it, living in Cairo or Berlin or London, etc.
Sure. When did you become interested in Arabic literature and the Nahda specifically?
Okay. Thank you for this question. So I actually started out as a student of English and comparative literature, not Arabic literature at all. And I spent a lot of time, I was at the American University of Cairo, and I spent a lot of time taking courses from different majors because I couldn't decide what I wanted to major in. And these are the majors I was just describing. So law, philosophy, history, literature, but not Arabic literature. It was actually English and comparative literature. And it was really funny because I think it was in the classes of English and comparative literature that I started thinking about wanting to shift to Arabic literature. And specifically, I remember two classes that on the surface are not really concerned with Arabic literature at all. So the first one was a class with Professor William Milani, and it was on modern literary criticism and literary theory. And the second one was with Nelly Hanna, and it was about Ottoman history. And at the time, I started finding myself being interested in how we write the history of modern Arabic literature. And slowly, I became aware that the 19th century is often perceived as the central moment for that history, but that somehow it is cut off from the 18th and the 17th century. And like up until today, if you wanted to find a study that discusses kind of literary history in Arabic from the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, they're not connected. Right? They're completely different periods. And I started off in studying the 19th century with a desire to think of those periods in connection, and quickly realized that it's somehow impossible because of the way in which we think about the 19th century. So even just to jump forward, part of what I'm trying to think through in this book is if we were to start thinking of 19th century Arabic literature differently so that we can actually think of it historically, what would that look like? So that's kind of the challenge. But it started early on in sophomore and junior years when I was actually still studying English and comparative literature.
Thank you so much. And when did Literary Optics became a reality for you as a book project? Was it like emerging from a dissertation, or how did it evolve for you?
So I think we can continue from those random moments of just sitting in classes as an undergrad and wanting to find ways in which, you know, wanting to understand how we've written about modern Arabic literature and its history. And reading so many random things from just encyclopedic literary histories to critiques of Eurocentrism and its relationship to how we write history, to theories like a colonizer's model of the world and how it affects geography and cartography. So I was reading like really widely and random things. But it was a phone call that I had with Radwa Ashour, who is someone I did not know at all, but she just randomly happened to be the aunt of a close friend in undergrad. And I think I just wrote to Radwa Ashour and sent her a really messy piece that I wrote overnight about all of the questions, jumbled questions that I have in my mind. And we had a 2-hour conversation where we talked about pretty much everything, like her family, her children, my friend. And then towards the very end, she just said, you know, those questions are way too big. And she's like, at the time I was thinking about an MA. So this was like very early on. She's like, they're way too big for an MA. And to be honest, potentially way too big for a PhD. They're like lifelong questions. How about you read Muhammad al-Muwaylihi's Hadith Isa ibn Hisham? And at the time, I couldn't remember, like, that name felt very slippery. And I was like, oh, okay. And then 2 minutes later, I was like, what was his name again? Like, I kept asking her until I was like, can I just get a pen and a paper? I don't know why, but I couldn't understand the name for some reason. And I think this was my entryway into 19th century. It's just this, like, really, really random moment with Radwa Ashour. And from that time, I continued to work. So I did an MA in English and Comparative Literature and worked on the 19th century. So did Muhammad al-Muwaylihi, a sort of one of the early quote-unquote proto-novels in Arabic, which I don't believe in that anymore. But at the time, this was a common narrative, and compared it to kind of early novels in English and looked at them structurally. In the dissertation, I also just continued to look at Muhammad al-Muwaylihi. But in terms of thinking about this book as a book, it was not until I came to Beirut, and it was over coffee with a very dear friend, Kristen Brustad, who just decided she just volunteered a lot of her time, 4, 5, 6 hours, to help me think of this as a book. So it is based on a lot of research that I did during the PhD with my advisor, Ayman Dusoui, but a lot of the new framing for the book and in terms of how to situate it is a product of a much later thinking.
And let's look maybe at the title, because Literary Optics is quite interesting title for me, and Staging the Collective in the Nakhta. How did you come up with the title, and what does they mean for you?
Thank you for that question. Honestly, I don't think this was the first title I had, but every title I had some play on the same thing. So there were almost kind of two main nodes of this book that it moves between. One is about visuality. So I think an initial title used Making Visible instead of the Literary Optic. And then something, the other one is about the collective. These are two central parts of my thinking about this project at all the different stages. But it was also really trialing to find the language with which to speak that. One way to kind of explain that is we'd have to maybe try to explain a little bit how 19th century Arabic literature is often discussed. And it's often looked at, you know, across its long history, as a form that traumatizes a process of transition from kind of traditional into the modern. People have come to assess this process of transition quite differently, and there are marked kind of different trends in the field, but this perception has not necessarily dramatically changed. And one of the things this book tries to do is to actually think, is that even a valid way to look at form, right? Because the question that is lost here is, what is this form actually doing? Right? We assume that we can speak about this form through two other things, but how is it bringing those two other things together if it is in fact doing that? And that's the question I started thinking about. And to kind of explain this further, we can think through a list of typical formal features that have been elusive to explain in those texts. They are episodic. By that, I mean that you could have a single episode that's self-enclosed, and you could move those episodes around. It's not actually a text that develops through plot, right? It actually just develops through a frame narrative. There is a frame story, and then that frame story becomes an excuse. The most typical structure of that is a journey. So let's say you and I decide to walk around Berlin, and we stop at each part in Berlin, look at what people are doing, discuss that, and observe them. And maybe we'll find some people so curious that we'll start following them around the city. This is part of, I'm simplifying, but this is part of the structure of those texts. And so the question of why they are episodic, why the characters are stock characters, they're often even nameless, or their names are allegories. So you have the philosopher, the thinker, the father, the lawyer, the doctor, has actually raised a lot of questions. And it wasn't always simple or easy to understand why those texts do this. And often those elements were discarded as, well, they're signs of a fraught transition. And because they were transitioning, their form was not really mature, was the bad way of saying it. The better way of saying it would be unstable or hybrid or, you know, whatever the language is. But that perception remained there. And literary optics is meant to actually mark a shift. That if you were to look at these texts from outside all of these preconceived notions about what realism, for example, looks like, and you just thought about what are these texts trying to do, and you read their form, you'd realize that they have a visual agenda. They're organized as vignettes or moments of seeing. And we can get into that later, but that's kind of the first part of the book. And then staging the collective is the second aspect of this, which tries to explain why are they organized this way. So if the first part is a description of form, the first part of the title, which is the form of these texts, is moved forward through an obsession with showing you something, with making visible, which was one of my other possible titles. Then the second half of the title says, okay, why are those texts obsessed with this idea of showing you something? And what the book gets at is that it's trying to show you the collective, and it's like struggling with that. And so you become kind of able to see the form of these texts, but what gives rise to that form. This is basically the two sides of the title.
Thank you so much. And you talked about a bit how the 19th century is looked at in the literary scene. And since maybe when we look at Hourani's book, Arabic Thought in a Liberal Age, and your book now, how did the perception of the Nahda in the 19th century kind of change?
Okay, that's a really great question and a really difficult question. Because I'm trying to think in my mind, one of the things that your question does so well is to situate this discussion of literature within a broader discussion of intellectual history, right? And literary works are a big source, literary works broadly conceived, right? Are a big source for intellectual history in that period. Think about all of the big literary heroes from the Bustanis, Shidiyah, etc. They're also main characters in intellectual histories. So yeah, there is that connection. And I think it's difficult to set the trends, but let's say that there are a few broad trends. So if we begin with Hourani, and if we think, you know, of Hourani on the one side and you think of Roger Allen on the other, those are the early, very early examples in the Anglophone Academy of people working on non-classical Arabic literature or literary production, right? Where you kind of exit philology and you start looking into contemporary practices or modern practices as something that's also worthy of looking at beyond the question of just the language or folk or local dialects, etc., which were looked at earlier. So these are those moments. And I think this is a moment when the question, and I think this is still the question, right, of how modernity arises in those parts of the world is a big question. And it's a question that's intermixed with ideas of colonialism, with dependency, with economic and political inequality. And there are those questions which are getting encoded in different languages at different moments of time. So early on, for example, just to give you an analogy of what I have in mind, you had these theories of modernization paradigm, which is basically that these places are going to modernize and eventually become closer to, you know, what whatever was like in Europe. And within that, you have something that would say, well, the 19th century in Egypt or Shem or whatever was like basically what happened in the 17th or 18th century in France. And within that as well, there would be the idea that eventually those texts will come to look a certain way. And this is so central to the idea of the transition. What I find quite captivating is that even when this narrative was completely done away with, right, from 70s, 80s, 90s, potentially even from the 60s, but absolutely in the 90s, it was dead to the field, I hope, anyway, that did not necessarily align with a complete change in how we see the formal aspects of those texts, right? We still don't necessarily always, like, they're still, like, super interesting attempts. But what does it mean to look at those texts and to look at their relationship with modernity without necessarily being obsessed with the question of transition, right? And that was kind of what I'm trying to ask. Not so much, so if we name the first trend, the second trend was more undoing that first trend, right? Writing back to it. And I think what I'm trying to think through, and whether that succeeds or not is another matter, but what I'm trying to think through is what does it mean to build on the long tradition of critique and writing against while being liberated from the burden of writing against, because that's also what the moment we inhabit. You're not really writing against anymore. You're writing for, right? And so this also becomes the task of who am I writing for right now? If I'm not writing to respond to older perceptions in the field, what am I trying to think about? So that's kind of one way to think about the trends in some way.
And looking now at your book more closely, you divided it into 5 chapters, and each chapter is dealing with another aspect of your research. How are these chapters connected with each other, and what can they tell us about your research work?
Thank you. So, you know, I was just telling you about hanging out with Kristen Brustad, my really good friend, and having her help me write a book proposal in its very early versions. One of the most tricky things throughout the attempts and the different drafts of this book was aligning the chapters next to each other. In my mind, and this is the dream, but I don't know how that would happen, you would be able to read all the chapters at once, right? You would see it as like one shared horizon. And in a sense, you could also see that in each chapter, I almost always talk about my entire corpus, right? I don't really focus on one text per chapter. I'm trying to talk about all of them at the same time because I'm trying to trace a formal feature that you need to see as a formal feature, not just as an idiosyncratic feature of this or that specific text. So for now, you can say that the chapters eventually came to be aligned in accordance exactly with the movement I'm describing in the title of the book. So if we go back, there's this literary optics, right? And then there's at the end staging the collective. This really describes also the movement of the book or the relationship of the 5 chapters. So we begin, and I think the beginning of the book is even in the introduction, where it's literally setting the stage. And it's analogical to what we're describing, that I'm trying to set out the trends in the field, and the field here is not just in the Anglophone Academy, but even in the writings in Arabic as well, of how these texts have been looked at. And what am I trying to do? Which is basically to say, let's try to offer a thick description of form. We're not now here concerned with how this form is positioned in a grand historical narrative. We just want to give a thick description of the form. Of course, you can never separate the two, but we're going to play this fiction together where we're going to separate them for a little bit. And so this is kind of the introduction. Chapter 1 begins with almost an exploration of, let's look at some of the features of those texts without trying to pass judgment on them or to say, wow, why is it weird? No, let's just actually think about those features. And what emerges is that there is an obsession in those texts with visuality, with a question of bringing something to stand in front of your eyes. And that this is somehow related to empiricism in the period. But here, the twist is that it has to bring something to stand in front of your eyes the way empiricism tries to do that when it comes to the senses. But A, it's through language, so it's not really your eyes. So what is that for literature? This is what chapter 1 is trying to think about. Chapter 2 tries to think, okay, it has that desire. We can see that in a lot of gestures. But how does that really turn into formal practice? What is it doing in terms of formal practice? And here I'm arguing that it's using something from theater. And chapter 3 takes us a little bit further, where it says, okay, but they're not just trying to show you something. They're trying to show you the truth of something. And that truth is measured against history. History is the criteria of truth. Okay. And so chapter 3 tries to understand what does that mean? What does it mean to use history as a criteria of truth? And what is history in those texts? How is it conceptualized?
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Chapter 4 continues with that thought, but it also realizes that history cannot be separated from actors, that those texts are thinking of history as the marker of truth, and it's trying to show us like historical truth, but it's also trying to show us historical actors. And this is when we get to exactly the question of staging the collective. Once you're thinking about the relationship of history and its actors, you're also in the realm now of politics, right? And you're in the realm for those texts of questions of collective agency in politics and in history and how literature tries to capture that. And one way in which this goes full circle is that the question of the collective is also a question of trying to see the collective. And the problem for those texts, if they are empirically inclined, is that every time you try to see a collective, you're only going to see a segment of it. You're going to see this specific group. You're going to see this specific crowd, this specific mob, but you can never see the collective as a force. And this is what these texts are grappling with in some ways.
And the texts that you look at and the works of the canonical authors from the period, like the author you mentioned, Muhammad al-Muwailihi, what do these texts tell us about their time? And when did you know that these texts are canonical maybe? And how do you know when the text is canonical and when not?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question. And it's a question that came up in the reviews. And I want to thank the anonymous reviewer because they also asked about that question of canon. And it's something that's also being discussed at the moment. And so I find myself thinking about it as well. I know that my colleague Zaina Halabi is working a lot on questions of canonicity, archiving, marginalization. What does that mean? So these are really current questions for our thinking right now. So in my thinking about the canon here, I took a very simplistic approach in the sense of these are canonical texts for our field. I don't know necessarily that I think they're canonical for Nahda literary production or how we would think of that. Of course, in a sense, the two are related because the canon is not always, but a lot of the time it's a retrospective activity. It's later times that decide what is canonical in that period. It's not necessarily coextensive with what is popular or what is mostly watched or what is really liked by people. But it's a way in which you build a narrative about a period, but also justify your own expertise about the period because you're an expert on those texts. You could say the same thing for the Abbasid period, the Mamluk period, right? It's a kind of a complex dialectical move. So I think it's obvious that these texts are, or a lot of them anyway, are canonical because of the way they're spread across texts from like works from intellectual history and literary history and literary criticism. And also because when I was describing that there was this old trend and then there was another revisionist one that was writing against it, for many of them, although not all, there are a lot of works now that are coming out on popular lit, they actually focused on the same works and the same authors, right? And they were offering reinterpretations of them. And I think this just allowed me to gesture towards this third approach, right? So I'm doing the same, there's kind of this tension of I'm trying to say, let's do something different, but I'm also doing it with the same corpus. That is a tension that I decided to accept because I wanted to gesture what just a tiny shift, not in our material, but in what kind of questions we ask about it would allow us to do. So for me, it was canonical because I kept seeing them everywhere. They're in books about history of education. They are in books about history of journalism. They are whatever you turn in works on the 19th and early 20th century, they're there. And that tells you they're canonical, at least for our field. And that any intervention the book tries to do will be relevant for those different fields. At least that's kind of the hope or the gesture. So this is how I understood that they're canonical, or you know what it means for me to think of them as canonical. But I was really keen on saying in the book that I'm not invested in saying that they are the most important, or that they are in fact, I'm not invested in those arguments about canonicity. But I think as a tactic, it was helpful to try to say what I want to say in this book and to try to think through certain issues. So what do they tell us about their time? This is also a really interesting and I think important question. If my arguments in the book are on the right track, in some ways they tell us a lot, and in others they tell us absolutely nothing, right? And I think I want to kind of abuse this tension a little bit. So they tell us a lot because they tell us a lot about how we have thought about the history of that period and why we've thought of that history in that way. And in that way, they tell us also a lot about our own present, right? So there's kind of a dialectical relationship here as well that I think is very telling. But in a sense, I also say they tell us nothing, because in a sense, there's sometimes this bias where we read a text and read it directly vis-a-vis its context, this whole idea of text context. Maybe I don't want to speak about that more generally, but I want to speak about what I'm trying to do in the book. What the book is trying to say is to ultimately say this is not the best approach. The best approach is to think about what kind of literary and aesthetic questions are being asked through form, and then to think, are those literary and aesthetic questions related to broader formal social and political questions? So to my mind, they're related through questions more than they are related through they tell you something directly, if that makes sense. They tell you what kind of questions are shaping the different fields and why they're being shaped in that way. But they don't tell you this was happening in that way. Or it doesn't give you a chronology or a sociology in a direct sense, but it gives you a horizon of questions that were pressing for those different fields and that came to shape those different fields.
Thank you so much, Maha. And how did the language of the text look like that you worked on, and what kind of challenges did you come across while translating them for your own research?
Yeah, so again, I think this question ties really well with the earlier question about the canon, because, you know, I think the 19th century is in a very interesting period in terms of language register and how things are being written. And it's a very explosive period of experimentation, different than the Mamluk period, but still an interesting period of exploration with language and form, with all of this explosion also of media. But because the texts I looked at are canonical, it seems part of their selection strategy was their language, right? So the retrospective selection of those texts as canonical has to do with the fact that their language is, in a nutshell, neoclassical. It's a very, very heightened register of Arabic, super formal, really draws on kind of poetic registers, Quranic registers, biblical registers, and their direct allusions to that. And there's also a lot of rhyming prose in those texts. There's a lot of poetic quoting. So that was definitely there. For translation, I did mostly functional translation. So I was not trying necessarily to translate them as a standalone literary text, but I was trying to do them as functional translations. But it was still challenging because a lot of my readings of what's going on are really rooted in super close readings of recurring words, for example. So I have to show why this word exists in a kind of a lexical and an indexical field and a discursive one. So I want to bring forth this entire force and world that is in this one word so that what I do with it later kind of makes sense. Otherwise, it would be like I'm overreading into something. Whereas if you're reading it in Arabic, you understand that it's tapping into a whole other world of discourse. So that was the big challenge for me in terms of translation.
Thank you so much. And I don't know if this question makes sense, but in what way are the authors from the Nakhda important to our understanding of the literary landscape today that we are living in?
So I think this question makes perfect sense. And again, I feel it's helping me kind of make that point. And I'm going to maybe repeat my same answer, but in a slightly different way. Super important, right? And not important at all. So super important, and I'm going to say that in two ways. So they're super important because of the weight we've given to Nahda in terms of understanding the history of modernity and therefore the history of the present. Nahda continues to be a moment that we visit and revisit in order to make sense of our present, right? So with every big explosive moment, 1948, 1967, even the Iranian Revolution, people go back to Nahda and think about it, right? And try to find there's almost a genealogical logic here. Like you're trying to find what went wrong in your present because it was not done properly in Nahda. This is a move that we keep seeing over and over. So there is that kind of importance, which I think is more ideological than it is genuinely that there is continuation. But there is one that I do think is a genuine case of relationship that's worth thinking about a lot, and that I try to gesture towards at the end of the book, which is this idea of the author or the voice of the author, or what in the text I borrow, Ayman al-Dusui's expression of the image of the voice of the author. And we can think here of works of, again, Zeina Halabi, I'm mentioning her a lot today, and Michael Allen, and even Ayman, right, who work on the idea of the intellectual, right? And so the image of the author there, remember I was telling you earlier, let's imagine that those texts are written like you and I are walking around Berlin and looking at people. So the author here is somehow invisible, but a big authority for seeing the whole, for making the social whole appear as a whole, even though they're looking at the little fragments. And they have ultimate authority over it, but they also sometimes, or oftentimes actually, take on goals of social reform or of education. And I think this idea of intellectual writer as prophets, right, which Zeina, for example, talks about, is very much owed to this, and very much in some ways, not entirely dead, right? Or even if it's dead, its ghost keeps coming back. Like I was just reading discussions about the landscape of critique post kind of our current moment and what's happening in it. And you would see that those debates are being evoked again. So in a sense, that moment of thinking with or against authorship and authority and image of voice are still very relevant for us. But in terms of actually thinking about literary form and what of literary experimentation in the 19th century is still current for literary experimentation today, we're only scratching the surface because we're only starting to think about these questions formally and not just politically or ideologically. But one obvious side is the question of experimenting with language, right? So how people now are trying to do creative projects that are about certain words or lexicons. And in some way that was already happening in the 19th century. Shadia is the most obvious example of that, but there are many others who were like that, right? He was not a standalone example. So there are those kind of relationships and resonances, but we're only scratching the surface with that.
And there have been quite critical studies published about the Nachta in recent years. How does your book fit in the current scholarly works about the Nachta, and how do you see yourself in this environment?
So yeah, that's also a really interesting question, and it's always difficult to situate your own work, but it's a nice invitation, so I'm gonna try to step into that. So I think one of the things that the field, if we think of it as a field of Nahda studies, has done to literary studies in Arabic in general was to bring it closer to literary studies more broadly, right? To sort of emerge out of this idea that Arabic is unique or that it lives in exclusively in philology or in manuscript studies, and to just actually bring it to the world of literary studies and questions about form and narratology. So I'm definitely part of that trend, right, of thinking those questions seriously. And I'm even part of the trend where I think you're seeing more and more people who are trying to think about critical and literary terms in Arabic, right, and to think about what they mean for us. So I'm definitely part of that trend as well. But I think one kind of difference or addition, or I'm not sure how to think of it yet, is that I'm not too concerned yet with saying something totalizing about Nahda at all, right? Is that there's an attempt to sort of say, let's think about form without necessarily quickly making arguments about where that fits in modernity in general or in Arabic literature in general. I'm hesitant about making those claims because I do really, not because I don't want them to happen, but because I think there needs to be a lot more work before we can do them. So there's one. And I think also the other is that sometimes there's a critique of Nahda itself, right? As a moment that bears that colonial legacy or that legacy of modernity as always colonial, etc. And while I understand the critique quite well, my investments are not in that either, because I'm much more interested in making those critiques about the present than I am about the 19th century. Of course, the two can be related, but that's kind of a moment as well where I enjoy a lot of those critiques and I've learned from them, but I don't necessarily follow in that thread or direction of thinking.
Thank you so much, Maha. And coming to the last question, maybe, like, Do you still planning on working on the Nachta on your next projects, or are you trying to work, or what are you working on next?
I'm asking myself the same question, but I think I'm actually moving in different directions at the same time. So I still work in the 19th century. And specifically, I've been thinking a lot about questions of conceptions of language in the 19th century. So if I've been trying to think a lot about how literary form becomes a visual form in language, I'm also concerned about what are the thoughts and ideas about language during that time. So that's definitely one direction in which things are going. But I'm also finally, and happy to say, going back to those earlier periods that I wanted to think about when all of this started. So I'm really starting to think about, which was the question all along, right? What does it mean to historicize without being necessarily beholden to periodization, right? So if you want to historicize without saying this is this period or this text reflects this thing, what does it mean to think about aesthetic questions through time without that being periodization? So these are kind of the things I'm thinking about. And comedy, non-canonical texts, non-canonical registers are definitely sites where I'm beginning to think about those questions quite dramatically different from my earlier first book.
Thank you so much, Maha, for your time, and thank you for being on the podcast with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tugrul. It's so nice having these questions with you. Thank you.